Hello, dear listeners. Welcome back to Wonkcast, the independent student-produced podcast produced from Policy Perspectives here at the Trattenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration at George Washington University. I am Eric Ledoux, joined today by Natalie Grogan, and we are both going to dive below the fold. Natalie, what is beneath the fold this week that our dear listeners may not have known about?
Thanks, Eric. So one of the things that were below the fold this week is an interesting article in Foreign Policy magazine about the relationship between the military and civilian authorities. So traditionally, there's a longstanding policy in the United States and other Western democracies of civilians being the ones who make political decisions regarding the military. For instance, when to go to war, how to go to war, exactly where, not just which country, what kind of tactics to use. And this policy of letting civilians run entire militaries of governments predates the United States. The Founding Fathers were very committed to the idea of independent civilian control of the military, especially because the Founding Fathers were leaving a system where an unelected monarch controlled the army. So when it comes to modern day, this article is going over a survey that was put out to the American public by the Pew Research Center about how much deference the United States leaves to the military when it comes to decisions, but even broader than political decisions at the highest levels of government, how much trust the American public places in the military as opposed to politicians. The survey came out with very concerning views about that the American public trusts almost 75% of the American public has a significant amount of trust placed in the upper levels of the American military leadership, much higher than civilians, to make these decisions. This has come to more popular attention when it came to the Trump administration appointing General Mattis to be the Secretary of Defense in 2017. There is a law that's been on the books since the end of World War II that precludes precludes the Secretary of Defense from being in the military within the past 7 years of being appointed to that office, and there requires a congressional waiver in the case of an exception. Now, of course, General Mattis is an exceptional individual, both in military experience and education, and of course we all know that ultimately he was confirmed to be the waiver was passed and he was confirmed to be Secretary of Defense. But that debate unleashed a question that most people don't consider very often, and that is, why are civilians in control of the military? And I don't just mean the President of the United States, although, of course, the President of the United States is the Commander-in-Chief, and all decisions about when and where to use the Army ultimately fall to him. Also, the Secretary of Defense, who reports directly to the President and cannot be, and by law has to be a civilian with at least 7 years' distance between himself and his military service. And also the secretaries of each military branch, Secretary of the Navy, the Secretary of the Army, they have to be separated from the military for at least 5 years in those cases. And that's because the civilian leadership is directly accountable to the people, either through direct elections, through the president, or by appointments by the president that require Senate confirmation. Those are elected to the people. So this debate really takes into account what it means to have an independent civilian control of the military and what the role of the military is. And the survey's results show that the United States public really doesn't consider what the alternative would be when it comes to military control of its own political decisions. Now, the military is supposed to defend the country and not define the country. The military is there to protect and not make political decisions. There's no elections when it comes to five-star generals, and there shouldn't be. Five-star generals should be based on their merit and their service. But there has to be some accountability for wide-ranging decisions, such as when to go to war, when to send people, citizens of the country, to war, where to go specifically in different cities, what kind of tactics to use, and it's really important that civilians are the ones to make that, to make those decisions.
Great. So when looking at that, that accountability structure, are there any particular issues that have come up or from history that reflect on where there ever were moments of like lack of accountability in military, in areas where there weren't as much civilian input into running operations?
Well, interestingly enough, just last year, the Trump administration gave the Pentagon, that means Secretary of Defense James Mattis, the authority to set the troop levels in Afghanistan to determine exactly how many people were going to be deployed in Afghanistan. And this was an unprecedented move on the part of the Trump administration by really removing the ultimate authority when it comes to presidential power over the armed forces. And that's a situation in which the military is taking orders directly from the general, who is the Secretary of Defense, and the president has publicly said that he would allow the Secretary of Defense to override him on certain issues. And General Mattis, as qualified as he is, was not elected president of the United States by anybody because he didn't run. He was not elected by the people, and he was not given that constitutional responsibility to make such wide-ranging decisions. So that is one recent example of a lack of accountability in the military.
So this is an example of the president delegating decision making to the Secretary of Defense, who is also a general.
Yeah.
And we can see where that could potentially lead to some issues. In other cases, because I know that the military also has its own internal court system for if there are certain crimes committed by military members, right?
I mean, there are to be tried in a military court is different than being tried in a civilian court. There's different standards of proof, but that's not ultimately what is at stake when we talk about delegating responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
From civilians to military officials. It's not to point the finger at any military officials. Of course, high-level generals have a wide breadth of knowledge and tactical experience when it comes to directing military operations. However, they're only looking at it with the direction of the military and not the direction of the people in the United States that elected the president.
Mm-hmm.
Because no matter what happens in a military situation, the president is ultimately accountable, even if he does not take that responsibility.
The president is accountable for the results,
right,
of those actions and decision making. And so the model that this is supposed, at least the model that this is usually, that is the usual model of like the interaction between the president and the military, is that the president has military advisors, as he has the National Security Council, which is often sometimes filled by people that he's appointed. But the point is that he's being informed by professionals from that sector to make decisions. And he's the one that actively and knowingly makes these choices, as opposed to saying, you make this decision, and maybe you don't need to tell me about it, or as long as you're accomplishing whatever I need you to get accomplished, I'm not going to ask questions on the details.
Right. So it's one thing to take advice, and president should take as much advice as he is given. I mean, and seek out more advice because that is such an incredibly difficult job.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody can know everything about everything. That's why there's a cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
And the advice given by high-ranking military officials is certainly valuable. It has to be balanced with advice given by civilians, such as Secretary of Defense, the secretaries of the armed forces branches, and also the secretaries of state and homeland security, which often interconnect when it comes to military action. Mm-hmm. Secretary of State certainly is always in high communication with the Secretary of Defense and the President, because diplomacy and war often go hand in hand. Diplomacy is usually used as a first attempt, and if it doesn't succeed, military force is supposed to be the backup instead of diplomatic efforts. So it's not this, the policy of civilian-military relations, it's not to denigrate the military.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's to balance the military with civilian expertise, and to balance the military with people who are Senate-confirmed or directly elected by the people.
Okay. So it's interesting to think about that, and because when we're talking about troop levels is a very large decision, and the ramifications of it involve many resources and a large military commitment. How does that compare to, say, when, like, let's say instead we're talking about like attacking decisions to attack specific targets in a hostile territory? So what would be the example of looking at, say, like the Obama policy of heavily relying on drones to try to, like, in a very precise way take out specific targets? That decision making, I doubt Obama was signing his name to every single like target approval. There's somewhat of a gray zone. Yes, delegating troop levels downward to the secretary is definitely a new precedent. And then what does that mean for things that are more in the gray zone of like the president has a certain mandate that he passes on to the secretary to accomplish a certain task?
Right. So when it comes to specific decisions, of course, there's always new decisions when it comes to the military, basically all the time. And the president, there's a long line of who makes the decisions. And depending on if it's Department of State, Department of Defense, there's a long chain of commands until it gets to the president.
Mm-hmm.
There's a joker running around that if a problem gets to the Oval Office, it's because it's impossible. It's because everything else hasn't worked. That everybody else has not been able to succeed, and that's why it's gotten to the president. So there's a long line of people. It's not just the Secretary of Defense and the president. They're undersecretaries for different regions and for different operations. And then you do get to military people, but the military leaders are always underneath the civilian authority. And so when it comes to specific drone attacks, they're going to be authorized by a civilian. And the civilian is somebody that was either appointed by the president or was already in the administration, but it's going to be authorized by civilians before actions are taken.
Mm.
Something that is coming up recently due to changing technology is whether cyber attacks and cyber warfare are given the same leeway as traditional military operations. President Trump has recently changed Obama directives about civilian control of cyber attacks. So cyber warfare is now being often carried out directly by military leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no recourse when it comes to a civilian decision about when and how to use cyber warfare. And it's so new, cyber warfare does not have the same kinds of long-standing traditions that go back decades than traditional attacks do. So this is something that's something to keep an eye on when it comes to the Secretary of Defense being a civilian. That person is going to have a different perspective than somebody who's an active duty military officer. And that's the point of these results that the the American public seems to have a great deal of trust in the institution of the military, more than civilians. Mm. And I think that is something to educate as a matter of policy, to show how significant it is for civilians to control the military and not the other way around. In the United States, it's not so much of an issue, but in other, in less developed areas of the world, when the military is in charge and not the civilian government, military coups are very common because the military has all the weapons. So in countries like Turkey, where the military is very powerful, militaries carry out coups.
Apparently it's like considered a normal resetting or something. Like whenever the democracy goes astray, the military saves it.
Right, and that is very common in some parts of the world. And a military coup is unthinkable in the United States because the military doesn't run itself. The military is controlled by civilians. So it would be impossible in the United States. That's why it's so important.
Is there anything else you wanted to add to the topic? Any other like particular stories connected with it, or other military decisions that have been made recently that maybe were made without the purview of the president?
I mean, recently we don't really know. These tend to come out several months after operations are concluded. It's something to keep an eye on, especially when it comes to future defense secretary appointments. Because when the law was first passed, it was supposed to be a one-time exception, and this was the case of General Marshall, who was a war hero of World War II. And the Senate explicitly said, this is a one-time exception, it should never happen again. And it has been 70 years since the last exception, so this is not something that happens all the time to be a military man in charge of a Defense Department, but it's something to keep an eye on.
Great. Okay, thanks, Natalie. So, for my Below the Fold, I would like to talk about a very small thing that happened in the news this week. Colorado and Connecticut are joining a growing number of states who now will be taxing online sales for online purchases. Sales tax online. As of December 1st, Colorado and Connecticut. This is part of a growing trend in states who are now following up on the precedent set by the Supreme Court case South Dakota versus Wayfair, and are starting to implement sales taxes. The significance of this is that there's a lot of money on the table that states had been missing out on, according to the Government Accountability Office back in 2017. States were losing collectively as much as $13.4 billion worth of revenue from sales taxes that weren't happening because of purchases happening online. So as a consequence of the South Dakota case, in which South Dakota created a law saying we're now going to collect sales taxes online, Wayfair, an international company that sells a lot of cheap stuff online, sued them because part of their business model involved underpricing their competitors because they didn't have to deal with sales taxes. South Dakota won. The Supreme Court set up a checklist of qualifications that they felt provided good reason for states to tax online sales. These criteria are fairly modest and are designed to make it so that are designed so that states can have their own taxation systems and it won't be too burdensome on online retailers. So for most of these rules that are happening right now across 24 states that are now taxing the online sales, this includes Safe Harbor, businesses that have transactions that are very limited within the state don't have those sales taxes. So for South Dakota, if you only make $100,000 in sales, or you make less than 200 transactions, you're not going to get taxed. You aren't going to have a sales tax. which you can see how there may be some loopholes around that. Also, the Supreme Court stated that you can tax online sales as long as when you pass those laws, you don't try to do retroactive collection. We can see how that can go out of hand. Billions of dollars from how long ago being suddenly grabbed by the states. Also, the Supreme Court said that states have to have single state-level administration of all the sale of all the taxes and the sales. There must be uniform definitions of products and services. That's all pretty straightforward for any kind of taxation system. The one thing that's interesting for what the Supreme Court stated is that it's useful and reasonable for states for online sales tax to have simplified tax rate structures. This also includes having a state system for setting what the taxation rate would be in different localities in the state. So instead of, you did an online sale to someone in San Francisco, so you have to know about the local sales tax, it's just, what's the sales tax that the state has set for online purchases? There also has to be access to sales tax administration software provided by the state, and there must be some level of immunity for sellers who use the software that are not liable for errors derived from relying on a state-provided software for calculating the state sales tax. So, following that checklist, more and more states are hopping on the online sales tax bandwagon. But surprisingly, we are still missing some of the larger players. To date, New York, California, Texas, and Florida do not have sales taxes on online purchases. But they're all looking into it, and we're expecting to see some movement on this in 2019.
A question that I have for that, Eric, is a lot states have vastly different taxation rates. So how do those get taken into account when you're in South Dakota versus Massachusetts versus Vermont? I mean, they all have different taxation structures. Is there some kind of method or process to ensure accountability?
So the taxation system for the United States primarily relies on the burden being on the seller to know what the tax rate is, although the Supreme Court made it clear that states need to provide some kind of software to help calculate that if there's going to be different taxation for different products within the state. And I suspect that, from what I've seen, the accountability structure is primarily that the states are keeping an eye on you. If you're a larger dealer, they will be audited. They will likely ask to see your list of what were sales from areas in our state to addresses in our state, from credit card numbers related to our state. Primarily the burden is on sellers to be frank with the states about what is the tax, like how much in taxes they need to pay, and what were the amount of the dollar amounts of purchases that they did in that state. So clearly, if you violate that, then you put your company at risk of being sued by the state and losing more money than you were trying to evade in taxes. And I also think what's important here is that this is primarily geared towards the Amazons, the Wayfairs of the world, these large online retailers that have lots of resources and can afford to include the different taxation, to track and include the different taxation models in however they keep track of the books. And from that first criteria checklist piece I mentioned about Safe Harbor, which is designed so that smaller businesses are not burdened with that. If you're running a small Etsy shop in Arizona, it's a side hustle for you. It maybe makes less than like $20,000 a year for you. You don't have to worry about this.
That's okay, because I was going to ask about the impact on small online retailers, because we think of Amazon, but there's lots of different, either Etsy or a small business that has an online component to it. Is there a way to differentiate between I mean, I guess it would be the amount of profit that comes in through this small business. But in your opinion, does this change in policy disproportionately impact smaller businesses negatively?
I suspect it will. I haven't seen any analysis that shows what the economic effect would be. But primarily, it's mostly been focused on budget and revenue from the state perspective. As for economic impact, I suspect that the very small businesses, people who are just sole proprietorships, that aren't in the six-figure salaries, aren't going to be affected because they don't have to worry about the sales tax. However, I would worry about people that are on the margin. So people who are making slightly over $100,000 a year would need to be cautious of. They're the ones that may see the most burden, because suddenly for making a little more in revenue, $10,000, $110,000, suddenly they might have a couple thousand dollars worth of compliance to deal with from the burden of keeping track of like their online sales. I would think that most of those small, I think the logic behind it is that the smaller businesses that are already operating within the state boundaries, they probably are mostly focused towards within the state boundary people, within customers that are within state boundaries. However, I can also see the flaw in that, because you could run a small business and it just happens to be that your clientele is all over the states. So we'll see what comes of this, but I think this also, that uncertainty of what is the taxation, of trying to keep track of the taxation for small businesses, this is why the Supreme Court made it clear that the burden is on the states to make sure that it's easy for businesses to know what those tax rates are and know what that tax law is, and also to have simplified rate for the online purchases.
Do you think that there's a possibility of the larger states that you mentioned, California, New York, Texas, adopting similar policies?
So right now, what I'm seeing, and I need to give credit to the Tax Foundation for providing a lot of this information, what they're saying is that they're providing recommendations that in order to stay aligned with the precedent that's been set by the South Dakota law, which is being used as like the metric to compare how standardized you are to other states, that what they're saying is that California, Texas, Florida, New York, the Tax Foundation is recommending that they make some legislative changes to what they're seeing as current proposals for creating online tax sales laws. But as for the specifics, not sure what's going on there. It could be, you know, for all you know, it could be that maybe New York wants to retroactively gather some money, which kind of goes against what the Supreme Court recommended. It could be that Texas is trying to allow localities to have more control over the sales tax for online systems, which would be a huge administrative burden on the state. I don't really know those specifics, but it seems like most states are going towards the South Dakota model, which is great. If they just model that, then if they follow the South Dakota rules, then it's a relief for most businesses, because then all you have to know is where do I go, or who do I talk to, or who do I contact at a state to figure out like what's the tax law there, and then I just put it into my calculations, and whenever I get a purchase from someone from that state, there you go, that was the sales tax, we charged it.
Well, I mean, that seems like something that is fascinating as the world develops into more online shopping. You know, I think that that's something to definitely watch as it expands into the big consumer states. But that's definitely a change in this new technologically dependent world.
I mean, the significance of it, of states finally getting a piece of the online sale of online sales is that it helps fix some distortion in the market that I think has been caused from all these years of, oh, if I wanted to go down the street and buy from a local store, I'm gonna have to pay more in taxes versus buying it online. And, you know, with most organizations now offering free shipping, it's sort of the suddenly you're like, wow, it's actually easier, it's cheaper for me to buy something from online. And that distortion is creating a lot of, to me, it would be causing a lot of externalities of like local businesses shutting down, brick and mortar stores going away. And also suddenly you've made it economically more viable to go through this long-winded process of shipping goods in one of the most inefficient ways possible through individual package delivery. So to me, this is probably going to contribute to a correction to overcome a distortion that's been created from this almost like when did Amazon become the big online retailer that it is now? Like a decade ago?
Yeah.
About a decade ago is when it really hit off. So for over a decade, there's been this distortion, and now it's finally getting fixed.
I wonder if, do people really make their decisions as to buying something immediately, locally, or waiting for it to be shipped based on this change, based on this loophole in taxation? I mean, for me, at least, buying something online is more inconvenient because you have to wait for it. So I'm interested in, maybe there's different parts of the market where, I mean, buying your groceries is something, if you need your food, you need it today, versus if you're ordering more of a luxury item, maybe that edge of the market is more susceptible to changes like that. But that's something fascinating about.
Yeah, I can see how this might actually interfere with future development of, I mean, we've all heard of Amazon's weird kooky ways of like developing systems to deliver us everything we want at the drop of a hat. We've heard about like the drone trucks the mail person parks the car, drones with your goods come fly out and drop everything off at everyone's cars and then come back to the car and keep moving. This might stymie that development because now it's not as economically competitive. So we'll find out and we'll see what happens from here. Or maybe they'll find a way to make the delivery so convenient people won't care about the taxed good now. Hey, instead of 2-day shipping, you get 2-hour shipping.
That'll be nice.
Yeah. So this is us, Below the Fold, and thank you, dear listener, for joining us here on Wonkcast to go below it all. I'm Eric Ledoux, joined by Natalie Grogan. Thank you again for joining us all on Wonkcast. We're going to take a little holiday breather, and we will see you all when we get back in 2019. Stay wonky, my friends.